how long is a minute and like who decides and standardizes the length of 1 minute or 1 hour or 1 second.
Welcome to our podcast, Was macht die Kunst? I'm very happy and excited to be here on board the MS Europa 2 and to speak with you, David Horwitz. David Horwitz is an artist living in LA. He is working in a range of media from performance and digital art to photography, participatory installations, and we are going to talk about some of his projects right now. He's a conceptual artist and works with materials too, not just with ideas, but these ideas materialize in certain media, and we are going to talk about those media as well, among them the ocean, glass, and the internet. So welcome, our first, the German question, was macht die Kunst? What is art up to these days in your life, David?
It's just drifting away. Trying to catch it.
Being on board.
Yeah, well, it's always kind of moving and floating.
Yeah. Right now we are somewhere in the Pacific, somewhere between Canada and California. Our next station is going to be, well,
Eureka.
another 2 days on the sea. So you have some shows coming up. One will be in Japan, one will be in Los Angeles, and one will be in Bad Homburg. My hometown, Blickachsen, is a biennial of sculpture in the beautiful park of Bad Homburg. And maybe you can say a little bit about what you are planning for this biennial.
Well, this is an extreme place to start.
Well, we're in the Pacific. We might as well start with Bad
so,
Homburg.
I mean, it might be, we'll have to explain. So I was invited to be in the biennial in Bad Homburg. My grandmother would have spoke German. So,
well, I wish she was here too.
Yeah. I should have learned. And so it's a sculpture biennial. It's been going on, I think, since the 70s, but maybe earlier. No?
I don't think it's that old. No.
Oh, not
because it was a classmate of mine that founded it.
Okay, sorry. I've been missing.
Not a classmate. It's someone from my school.
Oh, never mind. I thought it was older. But so I was invited by the curator, and I have this garden project in Los Angeles that's kind of like in between a garden and an artwork. We could discuss this later. And then I have this plants, this sculptures. I host performances and events. And one of the sculptures I have is my daughter's bed from when she was 4 years old.
Her bed?
Yeah. I had hacked it apart and built this stand for crows. And then we leave, I or whoever's in there leaves food on top of the stand. And the crows come and they take the food. Crows have memories and really strong memories. They can memorize people's faces. And they remember who's nice to them, who's mean, who gives them peanuts, who's like harasses them. Even if you harass them, they'll tell their children, and the children will tell their children. And they've done a study where like these crows, like 2 or 3 generations later, still remember who was bad and who was good. I think it was in Seattle that someone had this thing with a Dick Cheney mask and the scientific. I don't know. We won't go into there. But so I have these sculptures made from my daughter's bed, and one of the ideas is to not only befriend these local animals, but to get gifts, because crows are known to give gifts. And so I have these platforms that are built with, you know, I leave peanuts and other things, and I'm trying to get a crow to leave a gift for me. But it's so far they just take the peanuts and then leave.
So it's already up?
No, it's been up for years.
Oh, in your garden.
This is in my garden.
This is in your garden.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And so then the curator knows about this work. She wanted to put these crows perch or sculpture into the park. I forget what's the park called?
Kurpark.
Kurpark. And this was the plan. And all of a sudden at the very end, recently, a few weeks ago, she wrote to me and said that we can't do this. They don't want any crows in the park.
Wow.
But then I told them that there's already crows in the park. They're already there. You know, it's just going to be a place where they could come and get like a peanut. So they rejected it, and then like we have to think of a new idea really fast. And then I had this idea that, well, they don't want crows, they don't like crows, that I thought I would just, for the duration of the biennial, that any crow that comes in the city will be considered my sculpture.
Wow. Art with wings.
So that's what the plan is.
Wow. Do they know that already?
No, they know.
Okay.
They've agreed. But it kind of needs the whole story, you know?
That's true.
Yeah.
And how can people access the story to go with
it? Well, there'll be a plaque.
Okay.
And then there'll be school children that have t-shirts. There's a lot of stuff, yeah.
And what will... do the t-shirts have a message?
It says, I feed crows. In German.
That's funny. I really have a childhood memory, since we lived not far from the park when I was a child, from that specific park. And the crows came and they ate all the food. And I somehow there must have been something with a little bit of alcohol in it because they were drunk.
They got drunk?
Yeah, they were drunk.
Really?
Bad Homburg crows, they are very specific. Yeah.
Did you get a gift?
No, I never got a gift from the crows. Yeah. Although that was a great spread that they got there. They never gave anything back.
Yeah, they should have.
Yeah. Well, that just shows you what kind of work, what kind of ideas you are working with.
It's also reacting.
It's also reacting to a kind of a system, to a structure.
To a situation. Yeah.
You did that in a couple of things with different structures, not necessarily museums or biennial organizers, but also with, let's say, the structure of maps and Wikipedia. I'm thinking public access. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Actually, it's very relevant because it's over there. I think, are we at California yet? No.
Somewhere outside.
We're probably at Oregon, Washington. Public access was a project I did in... Did we look this up?
It doesn't matter. When time floats, we're drifting.
I think it was like 1991. No, just joking. It's 2011, I think. It was a project I did from basically the Mexican-American border to the Oregon-California border, the entire coast of California. I took a road trip, and I made photographs on the beaches of me looking out at the horizon. So there are these kind of like landscape photographs where I'm standing, almost like a kind of Caspar David Friedrich, kind of like referencing a kind of like German romanticism. I can't remember. I think I made about 50 of them, basically literally from the border wall, because the first image was shot in Borderfield State Park, and you could see the wall going into the sea. And the last image was shot at Pelican State Beach, which is right at the Oregon border, which is where there's a big prison. And all of these images, so basically I forgot to say, the work is called public access because the California coast is it's public land and it's publicly accessible. And so all of the beaches in California, it's like a public right. I mean, when I say all, it's like not the military base, but anything but like, you know, a military base or something. So if you can get to it, you know, that's a public place. And so I was going to all these different beaches, which are public, making these images, and then I was putting them onto Wikipedia on the page for like that beach. So let's say the southernmost beach was Borderfield State Park. So Borderfield State Park has a Wikipedia page for that location, or public physical space, and then public digital space, because Wikipedia is a website. I mean, Wikipedia is now old now, but back then it was like this new thing, and it was anyone could add to Wikipedia, and it was like a public collaboration with everyone to create this kind of like place of knowledge. And not only is everything that is made collaboratively, the images, the text, and everything, but everything can also be used without having to, you know, deal with like copyright. So it's like it's basically like a digital public space. And so this play with like the California coast and Wikipedia was a play between digital and physical public space and like public access and like all these questions that come up. But then what ends up happening was, as I'm putting these images on Wikipedia, there are these Wikipedia editors who are watching me, and then they freak out, and then they end up banning me from Wikipedia. And because they're like, this guy is doing something. He's up to no good. He's an artist. Like, what's he going? Like, what's he doing? He's like messing around on Wikipedia. I mean, everything I was doing was, there was nothing wrong, because I was putting images of the place on an article about the place. So there was, you know, it was some places, some articles didn't have any photographs. So they were like actually useful. There's a whole like weird subgroup in Wikipedia of these editors who are just kind of like almost like bullies and trying to control the territory. Even though it's public, they're trying to also have this like assert some kind of control over it. And then this is really funny because then this is like a homeowner in Malibu who has their house built on the beach, and the beach is public, and there's a pathway next to their beach that's like a public path, and then they block it. And then they're like, wait, you can't do that. And then the state has to come in and unblock it. And then the security guard, they hire a security guard to like, oh, you can't walk here. And they're like, no, actually, we can walk here. So it was actually, and this was like an unexpected outcome of the project.
So it's, and it has a root in German romanticism, but it also becomes this political thing of today. Who has the right to go to the beach? Who has the right to be in a picture? How do pictures get on the internet? How is public knowledge made? And so
it's also a road trip.
And it was a road trip.
And it was like, wait, okay, we're going to stay in Big Sur tonight, Dietzens, and then we'll have breakfast at Big Sur Bakery, and then it's fun.
So are any of these pictures still on the public access on Wikipedia?
Well, so what ended up happening was all the ones I put up with that IP address were removed because they were able to track them. But there was a few which I used a different IP address. And I don't know, they might be. We could look.
So do you have a list of 50 beaches and you can look up each one? Maybe you're still standing in there as a little figure on the beach. How do you make money? I'm just thinking, this project to me sounds so interesting, but I don't see a business model behind it.
I take Venmo donations. I could pass out my Venmo QR code. Well, I mean, that project...
Did somebody fund it?
Originally, it was SF Camera Work. It was commissioned for an exhibition. And so they would have given me probably not a lot of money. I have a friend. So as I was driving, I would just invite friends to come with me. Maybe, I can't remember. Did you? Bolinas? And also Bodega Head, I think. Bodega Bay. But I had this friend came from New York to ride with me. And she thought we were staying at like 5-star hotels the whole time. And then was disappointed. And I was like, who's paying for that? We ended up staying at 1 5-star hotel because we were in Albion, a beautiful town on California coast. And we didn't have a place to stay. And we begged this hotel. And they're like, okay, you could stay for $50. Wow. It was like a $500 hotel. There's like 3 artists in a car. And we had like a bottle of champagne and this... but it was, you know, they paid for the expenses and they paid for the work, and there's not really any other money. But then, you know, their artwork, so then a gallery could sell them. I did it like 2011, and so then, you know, as time goes by, it's like a work that potentially if someone's interested in, they could buy it. So then the LA County Museum of Art bought it a few years ago.
The LACMA, we also... went with our program out to sea.
So they own one. They own a set of the images.
So these would be the photographs, the original photographs you took?
Photographs and the Wikipedia articles printed. And in this museum in France called Le Silo, which is in the Independent Collector's Book. It's outside of Paris. They have one. It's mostly for me, French collectors. It's French collectors. That's how I make money.
Oh.
Yeah.
How come?
I don't know. We got to ask them. I think the French have some affinity towards like California. It's like, oh, there's this guy who wears sandals. Like, we should buy his work. I mean, I think there's always been this kind of connection with France and LA.
And maybe the connection between France and conceptual art. I mean, France brought us Marcel Duchamp. Maybe that's a reason. There's one project a set of projects that deals with the reality of being an artist and making a living. It's called Studio Rent, and it's an addition. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so the Studio Rent project was basically me. The basic idea is just me selling my rent so that my rent is subsidized by an art collector or anyone. You know, you don't have to be a collector. And so let's say my rent is like $1,100 a month. So I divided it by 10, and that was like 1,020, I don't know, 20, I can't, 1,100, $110.
Yes.
And then I sold editions of 10 of those for each month. And then when someone would pay that, they get like an artwork. And so you can think of it as two ways. Like you can think of it as someone is buying the artwork. Like this month, you're going to get, I'm just going to make this up, a photograph of the horizon from this boat. That's not, I just made that up. And so maybe you're buying that because you want that, or maybe you're buying it because of the concept of the work, which is basically subsidizing my studio. And it's just like straightforward. It's like, okay, I sell this and then I have my art studio paid for. But it also doesn't pay for the internet or the other costs that show up.
Studio rent would be an addition, and you mark it as an addition because you have a stamp that says...
Yeah, it gets studio. Stamped, and then I sign it, and, okay. And there's 10 of them for each month.
And if, let's say, if I wanted to have a subscription to this edition, I would get a yearly subscription? Or in what?
That's ideal. Ideally, you would sign up for 1 year to make it easier for me.
Yeah. So then collectors have 12 works of art that could range... Is there always something physical attached to it? Like, would it be a print, or could it be just an
idea? It's usually physical, but sometimes there might be like a digital file. Like, I might do a sound work, and then the sound work would be like a file that if they wanted to exhibit it, you could put it on like a speaker or something. So there's not many things.
An old project of yours that Christian Schwamm, the collector, owns is very poetic and beautiful and cost only $1. So that was, can you say what it was?
Yeah, it was called I Think About You for 1 Minute. So you give me $1 and then I think about you for 1 minute and I send an email when I start and when I stop. And so then that's like conceptual art, but it's also you have these two documents that serve as like evidence. So some people could print them out. And you could have, you know, here's like the thing that you own that costs €1, which now if you print it out at a copy shop, it's going to cost more than $1 to print it.
And the second email is, now I stop thinking
about
you?
Yeah.
It's also beautiful, but very sad too.
Well, you only paid $1. Yeah,
true, but I mean, when somebody would tell you, I will stop thinking about you now, it sounds almost like a breakup.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of you now sounds very poetic and almost romantic. Yeah.
And then it's over. Well, you know, everything has an end.
you mentioned German Romanticism and Caspar David Friedrich. I see that influence in another work of yours and another very strange work of yours, Mood Disorder. Uploaded an image on Wikipedia, so it was copyright free. Anybody could use it, and it shows you.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, just head in hands.
Despair.
In despair, you could find this picture if you searched for the word mood disorder on Wikipedia. So then you find this image and anybody can use it. What happened next?
So basically, Wikipedia, like I said earlier, being like a copyright-free place, people who want stock image and they don't want to pay for it but also want to use it legally, Wikipedia is a great source because you could use any of the images for free. And so then a lot of articles about depression, antidepressants, mood disorder, mental health, that didn't have money, like these articles, these websites that didn't have money to pay like Getty Images for the like exclusive rights for an image, would go on Wikipedia and they would find my image and then they would use it. I did when you search for an image, like a reverse image search, and then there were like hundreds of websites that had me on it with these like articles. Like there was one called like Postpartum Dad Depression. There was one called Depression and Yeast. There was an article called, like, What If I Never Get Better? There was one, Americans Are Literally Being Worked to Death. And so it's all of these articles that were, you know, they don't want to get sued by using, like, a copyrighted image. And they don't have money to pay for a copyrighted image, so they just get a free image.
I saw also there was one for erectile dysfunction. So, it's just weird to see how this one image that has some kind of, even looks a little bit romantic or even older. I mean,
it's like this.
Yeah. We have talked about how little one of your work, your cheapest work cost, but you have also used the art market as your playground. I'm thinking of Freeze. You did a project there. Does it have a name?
Oh, yes. We should have fact checked everything first. But okay. This is True Courtship Dance.
That's the work at Freeze where you hired a pickpocket?
Yes.
At Freeze where billionaires go shopping. And what happened next?
So the project was, I hired a pickpocket, and it wasn't announced really what it was that they were giving out, but the pickpocket would go through the fair and put sculptures in people's pockets, ideally with them unaware. He said he was caught twice, but two out of, like, I think 800. It was a full-time job. He was hired. He you know, he had a lunch break and, like, little breaks in between. But he was there from, like, the VIP preview to, like, the last day on Sunday, which are long, long hours.
So some people never found out they got a new sculpture in their bag while they were strolling this major art fair.
Yeah, because you have to think about, like, there's so much happening at the art fair, and you can't know as a viewer, as an audience, you can't know everything. And so you don't know every project. And so what is one project where someone has this, like, thief going around, then you might find this thing in your pocket and you have no idea how it got there. You might find it in your pocket and you go, oh yeah, this is David Horvitz's project, I read about it. Or you might find it in your pocket and you have no idea what it is, but then someone's like, oh, that's David's project, and then you read about it. Or you never know, or maybe you never even find it. It's like deep down in your bag. Like I met someone who found it in Argentina like 8 months later.
Wow.
Because it was in their backpack. It just went to the bottom of their backpack. Or someone finds it in like a laundry machine. Someone was in like Lower East Side of Manhattan and they were like reaching for their cigarettes and they found this thing and they were like, what? And so then they might not even know it came from the fair because it just traveled with them somewhere else. And the idea was that when a seahorse mates, the female lays her eggs into the pouch of the male. So she comes, they have this dance, it's the true courtship dance, is this beautiful dance that seahorses do where they're like, their tails are intertwined and they like, you know, drift and float in like the tides and like go around sea grasses and stuff for like days. And then at the culmination, the female puts her eggs into the male's pouch. And then later the babies, when they're hatched, they come out of the male. And so the idea was like, you know, the pickpocket is putting these things into people's pockets, kind of like the seahorses. And also maybe it's like a dance, you know. He's like, you don't know you're dancing with him, but he's dancing with you and then like doing this.
That's such a beautiful idea. And also maybe interesting that it's like a little kangaroo, but it's the male who has the babies with him.
Yeah.
So
or like the American possum.
Oh.
Yeah. We have
they
one.
Also have a
marsupial
pouch.
How do you say it? I always forget what's the word? Marsupial.
Cut the I don't know.
Marsupial.
Marsupial. Yeah, marsupial. That sounds right.
I think there's 68 marsupials in North America.
Wow.
Opossums.
Wow. Back to the Freeze project, the true courtship dance. I also wonder, how did you find a pickpocket?
Freeze. So when you have like a really good production, like not just a production budget, but you have like a big team, then you could start asking. You just like, I want a pickpocket. And all right, we'll get back to you in a week.
And they find a
We have four. You could come and meet them.
Wow. And for them, it was probably also the first time that they put something into someone's pocket.
One of the one that we picked was like, he made four series DVDs about his techniques that he sells mostly to magicians. And then the fourth DVD was putting stuff back in.
Ah. Well, but you don't want, I think it's not going to happen on this trip because we all have a plane to catch and that you don't want anyone putting anything in your pocket before you board a plane. Who knows what it is made from?
Yeah, it could be.
Anything.
Yeah.
Could be dangerous materials.
Cannabis.
But speaking of airport securities, even that system of airport security is a material for you or an inspiration for you in some way. I've heard of a work that you did including airport security.
Yeah, well, there was actually many, I just realized.
Really?
There was a lost watercolors. I forgot about this. I would lose watercolors in airport security.
On purpose?
Yeah, but it would have an address on the package. And then usually they would arrive at that person's address like months or years, depends on where it is. If it was like Italy, they would never arrive. If it was Switzerland, they would arrive in like 2 days. Maybe in like US, they would like wait a month for someone to claim it, and then no one claimed it, then they would send it.
So postal workers are really busy with you. You also had a project at Tate Modern where you wanted people to send nothing to the Tate Modern. How did you find people who would participate, and what does it mean to send nothing?
Yeah, this is old. This is so, I don't even know what year this
was. Still, sounds still fresh to me.
2010. Maybe it's not, yeah.
2010 was a great year in your vintage.
It was
vintage.
Like highly prolific.
Yeah.
It was like my golden years. it was in the Turbine Hall, and it was basically like an anti-art fair. It was for like nonprofits, and Rhizome, this nonprofit based in New York, based out of the New Museum, invited me to do a project. And so I had this open call for anyone to submit, and people would just have to mail basically empty boxes. But what was nice about it was when you mail it internationally, you have to declare the value. So it was basically these empty packages, but with all declared values. So, like, you know, someone could declare their package worth, for insurance, $100 or $1,000 or $50 or nothing. But it was all, they were all completely empty. So it was these like insurance values, traveling to London. They were all tracked. So we had a website that would follow them all, like on a live map. Then they ended up in London, and now they're in Berlin or outside of Berlin.
In the Schwarm collection. So these boxes were displayed, of course not opened, but they were displayed in the museum altogether. How many people participated? How did you find them?
This was so long ago. 130.
Wow, okay.
Well, a lot of people want to be, you know, in the show in the Tate.
Wow, and they can claim now that they had nothing at the Tate.
Yeah.
And you also, I mean, one of your projects that involves a lot of people that I saw in one of your great books was the call to have your own head, I mean, all these people's head photographed in the freezer and then shared on a website.
Yeah, this is a really complicated, I mean, if we want to talk about it, I propose this idea that people can stick their head inside their freezer in their house. It's just a good joke. And then photograph it and then put it on the internet with this crazy keyword that I made up, which is a string of numbers like 557-22333, just completely random. And then if you look that up in a search engine, the photos would appear because you would tag your image with that. And before the project, if you look up this number, there's nothing. There's like nothing on the internet with this string of digits. And all of a sudden, people started doing it, and there were like hundreds, thousands of images of people putting their head in the freezer using this weird number. And it was like just this way of thinking about digital photography and tagging, because like tagging and keywords was like a new thing. Like now you know, you put something on Instagram and you hashtag it, and it's a way of basically organizing images on like digital platforms. And so this was like a new idea. And so then I was just kind of playing with this idea of the tag. And then like anything on the internet that gets a lot of attention, it's like something really stupid. And so it's like, oh yeah, we'll stick our head in the freezer. It's funny and it's stupid. But it's also interesting. Like you can see in people's freezers, and that's like such a nice portrait of someone. Like if you open your fridge, it's like, that's who you are. You're like into Asian things, you know, a lot of tofu. The San Francisco Museum of Modern Art bought that. So they technically own that work.
And it also exists in a printout version?
Yeah, they have to print them out themselves.
Okay. What you say, that it's almost like a portrait of a person, what's inside the fridge. I mean, basically, whatever you have in your fridge is some kind of collection too. I'm always very interested in collectors, and every collection is somehow also a portrait of the collector. But to see it that way...
Or of their advisor.
True. Yes, of course. Yes, especially with high-value collections. But I kept thinking, when I'm in the supermarket and I look at the stuff that the person before me, you always have an image of, is it a lot of things? Is it five yogurts or is it just one? Do you think, do they have a family? Oh, sometimes I think the grandkids are coming because there's lots of sweet. To see that same thing in a fridge and then a photograph of photograph of the fridge, which is a self-portrait because they took pictures pictures of themselves. And in very funny positions. Sometimes the freezer was so high that they had to climb on something and to stick their head in. And then there's this beautiful girl with a peach. And then there's others who look totally ridiculous.
That's so in the book here, right?
That I saw in the book, yes.
Okay, there's some books here everyone could look at.
Right. About, you said mailing is often part of the process of these works, but also airports. So you had this one project where you found out that if some lost mail, or is it lost baggage even, is never retrieved, then it will be auctioned, right? And so you had a call to these people.
Hey, where was this?
Hello, Georgia. Where I saw
in
it
Georgia.
In the book.
Oh, yeah. So this book is so old.
Really, then I know more about you than do
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
So there was an invalid address on it and no return address. So what do mailmen do with this? They send it to Georgia because in Georgia, some of it will be auctioned off. So they open the packages in Georgia after a year or something if it's not ever retrieved. And then they auction it. So they open it. And what was it inside? Always a picture that said, "Hello, Georgia." So wherever it was sent from, you knew it would end up in Georgia.
I don't remember this.
Of course, it was only a fraction that was actually auctioned off, but had these pictures, "Hello Georgia," on there. So I thought that was
I kind of remember.
I think it was sometime in 2010. That was a very fruitful idea. Fruitful year in your career.
That was 2009. That was from a project. I never remember. I was doing these things every day.
That was
so there were 365 of them, so that's why I can't remember them all.
Oh, wow, that's a lot of ideas. How does the medium glass play a role in your work?
I mean, I've made a lot of different works in glass, and they all kind of come up and do different things. Like there was this one piece, thinking about the ocean, it's, sea glasses, the glass that you find on the beach that's kind of been weathered away by the waves, and it's like smooth. But I would collect these, and then I would melt them with a glass blower and a glass studio. We'd melt them down and then blow them back into different shapes. And this is something you're not supposed to do, because each glass is a different source and has a different chemistry, has a different rate of like expansion at different temperatures. And so you're trying to take all these things and forcing them together and then trying to make it into one thing. Sometimes they fall apart. Sometimes they just completely crack. Very unexpected results. I actually, now that I think about it, I made one in Berlin recently with glass collected in Mitte near Rosa Luxemburg Platz on the street where my grandmother was born in 1906. She left in 1912, and that's why I can't become a German citizen.
Oh, okay.
If she left in 1930, I could become a German citizen.
Interesting.
So I tried to become German. It didn't work.
You have a German wife.
British.
Oh, a British wife. Yeah. Well, then.
No, I tried to become German because of the laws were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. There's a lot of glass to be found there.
No, I know.
There's a lot of partying going on in that neighborhood, and lots of glass on the ground. Even your boat trip has to do with glass.
Yeah, so the boat trip was, actually Mia, my friend, came with me on that boat trip. And now this is 10 years later. This is our second boat trip. It was from Los Angeles. It was a very simple concept. It was, the idea was to move the time zone. So that was the artwork. It was to move the time zone. And then it's like a problem. Like, how do you do that? And then so it was like, okay, well, we just move the line. And so you look at a map, and the time zone, the Pacific time zone, the one that we're in now. Actually, I don't know what we're in now, because if we're out in water, but the one where California, Washington, Vancouver, Oregon, the West Coast. If you look at where the time changes into the next time zone, it's about like 400 or 500 nautical miles west of Los Angeles. And so I hired this boat to take us out. So we first went up to Santa Barbara, and then we shot west. And once we got to that exact point in the ocean, I collected 50 gallons of water. This is the materiality of this kind of intangible thing. And then we brought it into the gallery and put it north to south in the gallery in glass vessels, like hand-blown unique glass vessels. And in like my mind, it was like, oh, you, literally taking this line and moving it over. And then you could say, oh, yeah, well, you know, here's where the time. Oh, you know what else? I totally forgot about this. Department of Transportation in the United States is the federal body that oversees time zone management. And so then we wrote a letter to inform them that the time zone had been changed. And we FedExed it to them with a signature required FedEx, and then they never replied. But they had to receive it.
That's great. We started out with your daughter and the crows and the bed. You have two daughters, and one of them also made it to Wikipedia, I guess, but for different reasons. She was born in an Uber.
Oh, yeah.
First baby born in an Uber. Is she the one that you were also involving in a project during COVID? You got the Fluxus Award from Wiesbaden. So how did you involve your daughter in it?
So that was 2010?
2020 was COVID.
Yeah, 10 years later. I was awarded this award from Wiesbaden, and I was supposed to go there, but I couldn't go. So I was at home because of COVID with my daughter, and then we were making these lessons. And because my daughter's not in school. I mean, she was in school on Zoom, but she was also like not really, you know, that's not really school, just looking at a screen. And so we would develop these weekly lesson plans that were kind of fun. Like art activities, but also like things to think about. So each week I would write a new one with, sometimes she would write it, sometimes I would write it, sometimes we'd write it together. And then I would mail them to different people, and including Wiesbaden. And then they would put them all up. I can't remember how many there were. They're in a book over there. But it was for however long the exhibition was, there was one per week. And there might be, do you remember any of them?
One was, how long is a minute?
Oh, there was one about the names of the days. Like in English, you say Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And you don't really think about it. But it was like, well, what is Monday? It's Moon Day, or Sunday is Sunday, or like Saturday is Saturn, and Thursday is like the Norwegian god Thor. And so it's like thinking about like, oh, like what is like these histories of naming, and like why don't we change the names? So then there was like, let's change the names. Let's make up new names for the day. It's like thinking about like kind of everyday things and like questioning them. Like there was like how long is a minute, and like who decides and standardizes the length of 1 minute or 1 hour or 1 second. And there were more that there was like unicorn, something about unicorns. Yeah.
About the time and the length of time. You know, in the French Revolution, they changed the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are actually clocks that have only 10 hours on them. And the year had 10 months.
Because they wanted to get rid of the Christian calendar.
They wanted a metric, kind of a metric system for the year too. But you know why it faltered? The weekend was still only 2 days long, and it was a 10-day week.
Yeah, yeah.
Not kidding. So that was
the reason. Also hard to change, readjust these, like, you know, like you have a feeling of what time is, and you can't just train yourself, you know, a different different system. It's hard, difficult.
So I'm curious, with your work about that you inserted your photography in Wikipedia, or you kind of go into the public domain with your work, what do you think about AI? Because you created work that anybody can use, and you wanted people to use your picture for all kinds of things, and they did. But of course, with AI, and that's the big problem, that you can't decide anymore what AI is using and what is it not using, and especially for artists, if AI is using all your work and your creativity without you being in control of it, like you were in control, but with AI, you're not anymore. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. I think it's a complicated. I haven't really, you know, ask me in like 5 years. You know, it takes some time. With like ChatGPT, all of a sudden I was like, oh wait, I could write a proposal, and it was actually became a very useful tool. I mean, I would still write. I would still like, okay, I need to say this in 2 pages. And then it was like, I was like, oh my God, I just did that in like 5 minutes. So something like that is like very useful. I mean, ideally, you should also know how to write too. So like, you know, like with when my kids grow up, I will, you know, hopefully teach them that you could have like the skill of writing besides just like telling something to write for them. But like with the other, like it's like a complicated, you know, I'm not ready to talk about it. I haven't defined a position yet.
Okay.
No, but it's funny because it's like, oh, with like conceptual art, you know, yeah. Because like I don't really make, I mean, I make images, but like I don't have like a look where like something can just make images that copy me. But like, can it make can they copy my ideas? Like I was playing around with like my friend. We were writing, or he was writing this story, and then we were like, oh, what if you add a conceptual twist to it? And he was telling like, I forgot if he was using ChatGPT or something else. And then it started doing these really interesting things. And we were like freaking out. We were like, oh my God, this is smarter than us. I forgot what it was doing, but yeah, I don't know.
Well, the lesson book, for example, has very short lessons. And if you fed all this into AI and then said, okay, make 100 more of those, is that not scary to you?
I don't know. No.
Okay.
I mean, there's other things that are more scary.
Yeah. Like what?
I don't know, like ecological collapse or like the future. Sorry.
No. you can laugh or you can cry. It's true, of course. Yeah. We're living in dangerous times. At the end of my podcast, I always have a set of questions and I want to ask them. So if time travel was real, to what period and where would you go?
Well, I have to think about this.
You seem pretty rooted in 2010. Maybe you should go back there. No, I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. No desire to see the Italian Renaissance or maybe some...
No, I mean, definitely. But there's so many possibilities. We got to ask AI. Like, it could be like... I don't know, like we could go to Japan in the year 800. Like, well, how would that be? You know, or
to the future.
Yeah. I don't want to go to the future. Yeah.
What's your most important tool?
Japanese tea.
If you were an animal, what animal would it be?
I don't know. Dolphin, probably. Maybe a possum. Possum or dolphin.
What game do you like to play?
I like to just play without a game. Freeform play.
What's your favorite color?
My daughters would say it's blue.
She would say your favorite
color. She would
blue.
Say my favorite is blue.
Okay.
She's like, David, or Daddy, your favorite color is blue.
Do you listen to music while you work?
If I do that, it has to be like kind of non-structured music, like ambient music, experimental music, like kind of like Brian Eno. So I could do that. I can't really put on stuff that I have to think about, or then I'm like, I sometimes have classical music on, but then sometimes I can't concentrate.
What topic would you like to see in an entire issue of our magazine Weltkunst?
What topic?
Mm-hmm.
Rivers.
And the last question, can you share a wisdom?
Yes, I can.
Perfect answer for a conceptual artist. That's basically...
Don't stress out too much. Don't stress out too much.
Don't stress out too much. That's good. Well, thank you so much, David. This was super interesting to listen to your ideas and to dive into this cosmos of your amazing inspirations and projects. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our podcast, Was macht die Kunst, is produced in partnership with Volkswagen Group Culture. Thanks to the initiative, you can visit Neue Nationalgalerie in Berlin every Thursday from 4 to 8 p.m. free of charge. Every Sunday, Hamburger Bahnhof Nationalgalerie der Gegenwart can be visited at a reduced rate with a family program. And every last Wednesday of a month, guests of the Kunstmuseum Wolfsburg benefit from free access. Thanks to Volkswagen Group Culture.